Welcome to ContraPulse. This is Julie Valmont. Today we speak with Vermont musical legend Pete Sutherland. A warm-voiced singer-songsmith and accomplished multi-instrumentalist, Pete plays fiddle, piano, banjo, melodica, and much more for contra dances with his current contra band, Pete's Posse. And he is a founding member of the long-running contra dance jam band, the Clayfoot Strutters. While his music has powered thousands of dancers from Kodiak to Costa Rica, Pete is also perhaps the only old-time fiddler whose original compositions have been heard on both Car Talk and Hearts of Space. Pete is a veteran of many touring and recording groups, including Metamora, Rhythm in Shoes, the Woodshed All-Stars, Woods Tea Company, and Ira Bernstein's 10-Toe Percussion. A Renaissance man of the folk arts, Pete is also a producer, with over 80 projects under his belt, and a prolific songwriter covered by the likes of Kathy Fink, Jay Unger and Molly Mason, Nightingale, Altan. Pete has served as artistic director for a number of groups, including the Champlain Valley Festival, and most recently for the Young Tradition Vermont. He has been on staff at dance and music camps coast to coast, and is a widely known year-round teacher and performer at home. Pete and I had so much fun talking that our interview is in two parts. In the first half, he talks about his musical roots, how he got started playing for contra dances, and what the scene was like in the early 70s. And we got into how he teaches music theory and other topics. In the second half, we talk about what makes good dance music, how drums changed his approach to dance playing, the difference between playing in large bands and small bands, and we explore what it means to respect tradition without being a strict traditionalist. Hope you enjoy. Pete Sutherland, welcome to ContraPulse.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Yes, we're as with each other as we can be right now via the magic of the internet. How's things been in your corner of Vermont lately?
So I spent about 3 weeks being kind of like paralyzed about transitioning into teaching online. I teach anyway quite a bit, and I'll be happy to talk a lot more about that because it's really kind of, in a way, the gravitational center for my my own, you know, mental health and my own sense of purpose and stuff.
Well, you have these really deep connections in this, in Vermont, you know, and with the community, and, you know, being involved with the Young Tradition for so many years, and like literally generations of musicians. And, you know, I think about like Oliver, who now you play in a band with and you travel around with, and just, it's really, really cool.
Yeah. Oliver Scanlon, we're talking about. He's probably the guy that's taught me the most about mentoring. I was never really his formal teacher, but he's been a protege of mine in all kinds of different programs over the years. And in fact, is not only, as you said, just become a colleague, but he's on two different board of directors with me, and he's taken over the reins with the Young Tradition Vermont Touring Group, which is based up here in Burlington. And I'm kind of his senior advisor, you know, person. So it was kind of a 1-year transition over, but he's really doing great with that. And some of the people that he's been advising are already showing signs of being able to follow that path as well. It's definitely, it's unbelievably gratifying to have started those wheels turning and have them just turning kind of almost on their own at this point. I mean, they're not really, but it feels like, you know, if I stop pushing the wagon or the 57 Chevy or whatever it is I've been pushing, it'll just keep rolling fine and just kind of go on its own. And I don't know. It's just a great thing to look for, really. But I was born here in Burlington, and I have lived other places, and I came back 30 years ago. And I've like lived most of the eras of my musical life, which has been my entire adult life. Right here, except for the 80s when I was in Indiana playing with the group Metamora, Malcolm Douglas and Gray Larson. So I was based in Indiana then, but otherwise I've been here. And so you just keep doing whatever it is you've hung out your shingle saying that you can do for a long time, and people just keep coming, and you get referrals, and, you know, you get calls from complete strangers about this or that, and you get emails about using this particular tune of yours in this way, and it's just such a grab bag of happy fallout, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. How did you get started playing fiddle, and how did you get started playing for contrariances? I realize it's something I don't know about you.
Mm-hmm. I did not grow up with any of this music, so I heard some bluegrass in high school and then in college, and I got a banjo first, and I was kind of messing around with that for about a year, and then the fiddle that was on some of the recordings, both old time and bluegrass, kind of was starting to grab me, and coincidentally, my granddad gave me a fiddle that was not working at the time. I had to have it glued back together, and my brother's girlfriend gave me a fiddle that was working because they were about to hitchhike to California to join a commune. You can date this event pretty well.
Yeah.
Just a little bit post Woodstock. So 71, something like that. And I thought, great, this is really great. And then within like about a half a year, I met a bunch of people that were similarly inclined, and everybody was just trying to kind of figure it out. And so it was really nice to have everybody trying to figure it out as a group. And I was still going to the University of Vermont in Burlington. So by the time I was a senior, we had this very ragtag string band put together. And I was playing square and contra dances there, which is similarly, we were just kind of making up. We really didn't know how it was supposed to work. You know, somebody had been to, you know, a Dudley Laughman dance in New Hampshire like once, and somebody else grew up square dancing with, you know, singing squares. And somebody else had, you know, been here or there, and so it was just like, you know, it was like a stone soup of information that we were trying to put together, and then we were just reading calls and tunes out of books, and so it was, we were kind of like on our own little desert island up here, not connected with the contra dance revival that might have been already happening in southern New Hampshire and Boston and Maine. And, you know, this is like way before, I guess Pine Woods was probably going. I'm not sure. I didn't know about it. But it was way before CDSS kind of being a networking thing. It was way before Greenfield, and it was, you know, Peterborough, and it just, you know, it was kind of the end of the old era, I think. But, you know, we didn't really know much about any of that stuff. We just kind of like wanted to play tunes, and it was great if people could figure out some somewhat organized way to dance to the music as we were trying to learn. So that's paints you like a bit of a picture, probably. It's like, you know, we were just amazed. We were amazed that we could make anything happen. And a lot of the folks that were making it happen with us were international folk dancers, because there was a pretty active club going at the University of Vermont. And, you know, they had a good sensibility about it. You know, they could count to eight and, you know, clap on the beat and step on the beat. And most of them knew a ballroom swing. And so, you know, we weren't starting from absolute zero, but people were, you know, they hadn't necessarily, you know, actually done contra dancing or anything like that. It was just some intuitive ability to that. My very first string band, when I was just scratching away on the fiddle, really, I had no business. I knew some tunes, but I was just so terrible, and I had no business getting up there. But luckily, one of my friends who was a mandolin player had a pal in town who was a violin player, went on to be a very good violin builder. And she was really taken with fiddle music. She sounded exactly like a violin player playing fiddle music. And, you know, we've all heard that. But somehow, when you put her together with me, it sounded somewhat like fiddling. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had the attitude and she had the tone.
Right.
So, yeah, that lasted for a little while. And we had a guitar player who could keep a beat and, you know, the minimum requirements. So we were serviceable in that way. And that is a band that eventually sort of winnowed out. You know, it was a drop-in situation. You know, all kinds of ne'er-do-well hippies with backpacks came through with their mandolins or whatever, their banjos, and joined us on the spot. And then we never saw them again. But it kind of shook down to an actual band with about five people in it. And we started getting invited to play some of the local bluegrass festivals, because we were kind of this weird oddity of people playing old-time music that everybody thought, well, that's charming. And we were also interested in Irish music and Quebecois music, of course, because like we're only 30 minutes from the border here. So that's a thing up here, strong thread. There's a lot more to say about that part of my life as well, of course. But so we were trying to intake all of it and somehow reproduce all of it. And so it was just kind of like, in a way, exactly what a lot of contra dance bands have ended up presenting on the bandstand, right? Mm-hmm. Is a smorgasbord. Even if they're writing their own music, all those influences are pretty evident.
Yeah, that's kind of the standard.
For some reason, it's a standard. Yeah. Unless they became specialists early on and just said, you know, it's going to be Irish music or nothing.
Right.
You know. Yeah.
So you started your first contra and square dances, and none of you really knew what you were doing, and you probably had some fun with that. Did that make you want to seek out contra? Like somehow you ended up playing in a contraband mega group for 30 years. So how did that all, maybe 25, like Clayfoot Strutters, how did that evolution happen?
Yeah, that actually ended, that happened when I moved back to Vermont in 1989 from Indiana, sojourn I had out there for about 7 years playing with Metamora, which was a concert band. It was not a dance band. So it was a touring concert band, and I really missed kind of playing for dances. And I did play at the Wednesday Night Dance in Bloomington, which is the oldest contra dance in the Midwest. Had been going since I think 1970, and I moved out there in 82, the end of 82, to work with these guys. And so there was at least, you know, if we were home, we were not on the road on a Wednesday. I got to hang out there and dance and play, and every Wednesday night was a freebie for one thing. You know, nobody ever got paid, and so it was like pickup band after pickup band after pickup band, and you know, most of us know that Bloomington is one of those bright lights out there in the map, a college town, and partly because it has a you can get a PhD in folklore there, so a lot of, you know, pretty skilled musicians who are aiming at an academic career end up there to do that, and then they come down to the dance and have a good time. You know, it's a nice social occasion away from the books, hitting the books for them. So yeah, just amazing talent has always been there and been part of that scene. So I was part of that scene while I was there. And so, but that's the only dance playing pretty much that I did that decade. But it kind of kept my hand in the game, kept me learning tunes, kept my appetite whetted. Let's see. So it's like, in a way, the answer to your question is it's kind of decade by decade. So the 70s were the string band. It was called the Arm & Hammer String Band, by the way, which was born at UVM and played around and then kind of disbanded in 79. And then I just was kind of doing various things with my wife around, including just playing for dances, just fiddle and piano, which is, you know, is great. Mm-hmm. Two-person band. And other kinds of gigs. And then this opportunity to go out and hit the road for the first time in a big way with these Bloomingtonians, who were pretty well known already. And then that ended in about 89. And I moved back to Vermont. And it was that week, actually, the very week I was still unpacking, that Jeremiah McLean and Lee Blackwell called me up and said, we just heard you're back in town and, you know, you want to get together and just kind of jam. They had been playing, just really the complete history here. They had been playing some in a kind of proto drums bass big band version of Irish band called Celtic Menace, which played the local dances, didn't go anywhere. Jamie Gans was the fiddler, who lives now in Bloomington. Good Irish player. And Sam Bartlett, everybody's favorite bandmate, who is from Vermont. He and I are actually from the same hometown here in Vermont. And he was an early Clayfoot Strutter when he was around as well. And then a lot of other people came and went. Yeah. So we literally got together amidst my unpacked boxes in my little house in Fairfax, Vermont in the fall of 89 and had some of our first experiences that became part of the web of sound that the Clayfoot Strutters eventually wove, including getting together with this lovely Ethiopian musician named Seleshi Damase, who I was introduced to by my brother. And he came over and he probably made it to four or five rehearsals and did a couple of gigs with us and taught us like a whole bunch of traditional and a few original Ethiopian tunes that were just such a watershed for us too. And pretty much launched the Strutters on the path of looking at all kinds of world musics as source material. So there were the big touchstones of the early days of the Strutters were drums and bass on, you know, a back line behind fiddle, accordion, and flute and whatever. Mm-hmm. And then this, you know, came mini immersion in African, you know, East African music. And later some sub-Saharan music, because we were all really listening really avidly to a lot of that music from Mali, Tanarwin, and music from Zimbabwe, Thomas Mpfumo, and South African music. And we would just kind of put this stuff on while we were cooking burritos together at a rehearsal. And, you know, like, check this out. So it was just becoming this kind of like part of our heartbeat, right, pretty much from the get-go. On top of maybe some other things that all of us were already engaged in, like Zydeco or swing or something. That's kind of like the early Strutter soup making in a nutshell, I guess.
So who were the founding members of the band at that time?
Yeah, well, we could say clearly that Jeremiah Lee and myself were the three founders. Other people came and went again, as happens when you haven't got a gig yet. Yeah. The earliest one that stayed was Chris Layer. I don't know if you know him, but
Piper.
He's gone on to, yeah, Chris, a Piper flute player, and it turned out he had played bass in a rock band, like a sort of a glitzy rock band in high school. He's a very, very good bass player. So he was our bass player, and then occasionally we'd let him play flute or pipes or something. I had met him in Indiana when he was a kid at a Lobatine Sorion concert, and we had stayed in touch. And then he followed me east. He ended up moving east just a couple months after I did, and called me up and said, I'm waving at you. I'm right across the lake. And he had gotten a job at Fort Ticonderoga as the musical guide historian / piper there. And so he stayed at that job for 2 or 3 years and played with us all that time. And then he moved to New York City. And then he got involved with a Trinity Irish Dance Company and toured the world for a long time and did a lot of other things. So we went through a lot of bass players after that. I can't even really count them all, but a lot of them for a short time.
And then some of them for a long time. Bass player jokes.
Yeah, I know, right? Well, it's almost like Spinal Tap and the drummers, but, you know, it's just the way it works. You know, a good bass player is like worth their weight in gold, as we all know. And so it's likelier that they just had too many gigs and they couldn't make a commitment. But we were joined very happily in our mid years by Dave Grant from Charlottesville, Virginia, who was playing all kinds of music down there with kind of fusion bands and stuff. I knew him from old time music, but he is on our one CD that we ever made called Going Elsewhere. And between the time that we recorded it and the time we began to mix it, he was unfortunately killed in a work accident, which was just, you know, an unfathomable loss to all the music communities that he was part of. We had gigs on the books, and Peter Davis, who was one of the people that we'd added on, Mark Roberts being the other, who are now the kind of the long-term add-ons from the early years, both multi-instrumentalists, you know, just all, it's an all-star band. It's an amazing bunch of folks. And not to denigrate all the other people that have been in the band, but those are the long-timers. But Peter said, oh, I'll call up my friend Harry Aceto in Ithaca. And Harry was able to join on very short notice. This was like, Well, we were sitting down to mix the album, like 2 days after David's death, and burning a candle on the desk, and feeling all of that, and also looking at our calendar, going, "Shit, we have like 3 dance weekends in the next month." You know, like, what are we gonna do? And so Harry said, "Yeah, fine, I can do it." And so he's been with us ever since, which is amazing, and just the consummate bass player. So that was 2002, I think, something like that. My years kind of run together, but somewhere right in there. So the Strutters exist. If somebody offers us a gig, it's one of those bands now. Mm-hmm. But it hasn't actually worked in about 2 years. Mm-hmm. So you know how that goes. Not that anybody's working now, but
right. Well, yeah, for the last year, nothing's happened. I imagine the Strutters would end up at festivals or dance weekends that have the budget to bring in a bunch of musicians from all over the place.
Exactly, because we were a minimum of 5 people, and we really preferred to be 6 or 7, and we were as many as 9.
Wow.
You are correct. Not very many people have those kind of bucks. But Falcon Ridge Folk Festival, that was kind of our, like, if we're going to play one gig this year, that's it. And we had our own little illegal camp out in back of the dance stage, and with a couple of teardrop trailers and tarps, and it was called Utarpia. Utarpia, and attempted to have jam sessions there when there was a lull in the action, and
that's fun,
stuff like that. But Falcon Ridge had a budget for that kind of thing, and we'd play old songs and some dance weekends.
And that's, I've seen it, the dance flurry before.
Yeah, the flurry. Yeah, yeah. Not too much. Never too many gigs. George Marshall was really good at getting us on the road to do like a week, going down to Washington or Richmond and back. You know, and he always knows how to put those tours together. And so he was kind of responsible for putting us on the road at all. We probably wouldn't have been able to get that together. For the same reason, you just put a bunch of people in a band that are already possibly in 2 other working bands, or at least really busy, and it's kind of a rabbit hole. So,
George is really good at that.
I've been very happy a good portion of this last decade to be in just one band, Pete's Posse, that was created for the purpose of being the band for everybody in it. Mm-hmm. It was like the band. Everybody's been in other bands that are on the side, but it's a gentle person's agreement that this is like you don't get in the way of the Posse with your calendar.
I think a lot of dancers don't necessarily understand how and why contrabands come and go. You know, there's a lot of different factors, life changes and personalities and location and things, but a lot of it is just everyone being able to commit to it the same amount at the same time and wanting the same things as each other. And often in a band that changes, one person has kids or another person goes to graduate school and so I think it's great that you start a band where you all have the equal amount of commitment and desire to do it. And I would say that Pete's Posse, you guys look like you've been pretty busy. So clearly it worked.
it worked in up until, 8 months ago when nobody was, the start of nobody working live anyway. It was working just fine. And I think we're about as successful as any band in whatever categories you want to put us in terms of staying active and actually making some significant bucks at it through not only touring, but recording and other little side enterprises. So I'm proud of that. I'm really, in the beginning, it was kind of trading on my name a bit because the other two guys were not so well known in either the concert world or the dance world. And I, you know, I have to add that, you know, we're talking about contra dance music, and that's how the Posse was born as a contra dance unit, pretty informally, and then all of a sudden formally. But we were interested right from the get-go in singing and doing concert material. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, as we go back and kind of like sum up every calendar year and say like what percentage, it's interesting to us to crunch numbers. So what percentage were dance gigs and what percentage were contra? It's always somewhat between like 45, 55 swinging one way or the other. So that seems healthy to us. We would not want to do all one or all the other ever. You know, if it gets too dance oriented, we miss singing because we've worked hard on arrangements, concert mm-hmm. arrangements. But the main thing is it kept us on the road more successfully. I mean, a lot of contra bands do house concerts and mm-hmm. even sing and so forth, but I'm maybe not aware of too many that have worked quite as diligently on developing an entirely different set list for concerts. You know, we don't really even play any of our dance sets straight up mm-hmm. at all when we do a concert. There's a lot of dance kind of music or instrumental music, but it tends to be more adventurously composed / arranged, stretched out, reimagined, I guess might be a good word for it. More cinematic, and that just feels like a gift to be able to do that. So, but we know how it works out commercially. We know how it works out. You go out on the road and you can't play a dance every night. They ain't there. And besides, you go broke. So, you'll go broke fast. So, you can make more money doing an average house concert than you can at a fairly decent dance. That's just the numbers. And, so to be able to put together a tour, with the best of both worlds, is kind of just a lot of logic to that.
Right. Like if you want to be a full-time dance musician, it's very hard to then make a living to continue to be a full-time dance musician just playing dances. And so a lot of dance musicians do other things. They teach, they perform in concerts, they do other things, they have day jobs, they do all sorts of things. But I think there aren't that many bands who kind of do it sort of 50-50 with like almost equal love and attention to both. I feel like there are a lot of dance bands who sometimes play concerts and enjoy it. And then there are a lot of concert bands who sometimes play dances and enjoy it. But it's kind of neat that you guys have really, you do both with equal enthusiasm. I mean, some concert bands even kind of, you know, they might talk down about their contra dance music, like it's not real music because it's not being played at a concert, you know, but I don't.
Yeah, slumming almost. Yeah. They're almost like they're slumming. Which is, you know, not a very decent attitude to even imply, much less state. Yeah. So, yeah, it's entirely by design that we ended up being able to live that life, pursue that career. You know, it was very conscious. Thank you.
So during all those years of the Clayfoot Strutters before Pete's Posse came around, what other ways were you playing for dances besides your time with the Strutters?
Yeah. I was married for a long time, and my wife is a very decent contra dance piano player. So like I said, fiddle and piano, I mean, what's wrong with that? You can portray a pretty solid trad New England sound that, you know, it's still extremely serviceable. I still kind of enjoy it. I mean, I'm getting old and kind of like lazy about the entire prospect of being the only melody player for a 3-hour dance. I couldn't do that anymore. I would, my fingers would be literally numb by the end of the second hour, I think, you know. So being in a band where I get to swap off playing backup and lead and have an incredibly capable, strong co-fiddle player is just the best. It's the best at this point. And I really can't go back. So I'll play little gigs, you know. I mean, as we're talking about what kind of gigs we do, we know very well that we're not doing any gigs, right? This
not
is
right
all
now.
Theoretical. But if we were doing a gig, if you or I were doing a gig tomorrow, wouldn't that be fun? And it would be entirely possible that I would take a little gig that was like a 1-hour, you know, like wedding gig and play some dances or something. Or call, for that matter. I used to call, so I can do that wedding calling thing. I can call the Virginia Reel. I can call Labastrang. I can do, you know, it's like they're all in my brain.
Those are the best dances anyway. Those are my favorites.
Well, they make people happy, right? It's like, yeah, exactly. When I was in Bloomington, yeah, my wife and I would go, oh my God, occasionally we'd go up to Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, which is like 7-hour round trip on a Thursday night to play their little tiny contra dance and probably make $150 and drive home. And she would go into school the next day. She was in the opera program at IU in Bloomington. And I would get up and go to back to the Metamora practice studio and hit it again and have to just have an extra cup of coffee. But distances in the Midwest are like crazy for us Yankees, like a local gig, air quotes, a local gig. That's a local gig. 7-hour round trip.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Cincinnati, 5.5-hour round trip from Bloomington. Totally
yeah.
Local gig. Yeah. Louisville, 4 hours. Whoa, that's right next door.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hop in the car. Let's go.
Yeah, it's crazy the things we do.
That set me up well, Julie, with when I came back to Vermont and I was looking for similar kind of things to do before the Strutters really got going. I was subbing in as one of the thousands of fiddlers that have played with Wild Asparagus. And so I would drive to Greenfield and play the gig and then drive home. And that's, for me, a 5-hour round trip from northern Vermont.
Yeah, and that was easy for you at that point. That's just what you do.
It was easier because, thank God, there were rest stops. I could stop and take a nap. But it was like those dances went till friggin' midnight. And luckily, Dunkin' Donuts was still open. So stop and get some coffee and some sugar and then start driving. And
yeah.
And I think I get to bed usually. I get to bed around like 5 o'clock in the morning.
Wow. Yeah, we would drive from Austin.
I wouldn't do that anymore.
No, me, I'm too old for that now. We would drive from Boston up to Montpelier, play the Montpelier dance, and come back home that night.
And drive home? I know.
Yeah,
I know.
2.5 hours.
Yeah.
You know, I always wondered, Jeremiah is always all over the place from Vermont, you know, just do it.
Yeah, and he doesn't live near anything, really. So,
right. I was like, he has to drive everywhere to everything all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
So yeah. Do you, I mean, I feel like for many musicians, I can ask them like, what is your philosophy about, you know, this various musical thing, but you strike me as a person who has so many philosophies because you've done so many different things. You know, you write songs, you work with schools, you've played in contrabands that sound traditional and contrabands that sound new. And you like to, I feel like Pete Spassi always has a sense of mischief up on stage where you're always up to something. So I don't know what the right question is to ask you to get you to talk about all that stuff, but I would love, and you've also produced 80 albums, something like that. So you just have so many different musical perspectives. And of course you produced the Nor'easter album, which was the first time I really got to know you back, little baby, right. Julie, learning to play contra piano.
Yeah, right. I remember that. Yeah. I remember doing a little retreat with you guys at Middlebury College, actually.
Yeah.
We did part of our thing there, where I've been working for a number of years teaching. You're right. I don't think I have one guiding philosophy, except that I'm kind of open. And I sometimes get away with calling myself a kind of a general practitioner of music, of folk music anyway. GP. And what is that? And what the heck does that? You know, it's like, I love trad music ever since I first set ears on it back in college, and have never stopped. And I've also loved a lot of other kinds of music that are definitely, have you coloring outside the lines all the time, or there aren't any lines. I was in a rock band in high school. We skipped over that part. Mm. I was writing song. I was singing in glee club in high school, and I was composing and songwriting. And I was in college. I was way into, still the Beatles you know, some of the folk revival acts and Joni Mitchell and Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young and Incredible String Band and Donovan and, you know, some of the Woodstock Festival artists. And, you know, it was just like kind of top to bottom in the pop world with a little bit more ear towards the acoustic rock or acoustic pop. But it was just like all, it was like all rock and roll to me. I had this year where I was trying to learn to play the fiddle, and I was still listening to Led Zeppelin like avidly. Mm-hmm. And I was also listening to Tommy Jarrell and Fred Cockrum avidly. If that doesn't sum up something about, you know, like my crazy brain, I don't know, because I still feel like that guy, really.
I mean, when you sit down at your Yamaha keyboard and you play the organs during a Pete's Posse contra dance, I was like, I kind of know what you're channeling there, Pete. You know, it's like,
yeah, I'm right back there in high school. Yeah. Right. And I've never learned to be a better piano player. You know, that was probably the high point for me. I took piano when I was little, and I stopped when I just like was not having, it wasn't fun anymore. So 5 years. So I never got really technically any good, but high school, I realized I could play by ear. So that was, that kind of like got me in the door to playing with my neighbors in a rock band. And also I had a great ear for figuring out chords. So everybody be like, you know, what are the chords to this? And I could just like, give me a Sharpie and some paper, I'll tell you what they are. Mm-hmm. So it makes you an MVP in any crowd, you know, if you can figure out the chords. And you tend to be the, you know, fastest gun in the West at doing so. Then people, they want you around. It's still true.
Yeah.
A lot of my lessons are about theory now, and I'm really trying to always figure out like a better way to teach theory, applied theory. I feel like that's my life's work now. It's not really about teaching fiddle tunes or banjo licks or piano inversions. It's really about like how do you learn to integrate your left and right brain's abilities to really understand how to find your way around your instrument and use your ear and possibly, you know, like use some kind of ID. I'm way off topic here, but some kind of identification system that works for you personally in order to catalog all this stuff so that you can, you know, feel like you're building your own knowledge base. It isn't somebody else's, you know, that you're getting out of a book, and it's not because I told you that you should think about it my way or anything like that. It's like, you know, how do you really grok the landscape of music and it becomes this place that you can go over and over and feel at home and feel like, you know, boom, I've just jumped in the transporter. I beamed down to planet music and I know where I am. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's on my terms. That's my goal. Okay, so now we're talking about teaching again. And I don't even remember what your question was.
It doesn't matter. Let's stay here. We can go back to the other stuff later. I love that you used the word grok, because you know, that's from Stranger in a Strange Land, right? That word, there's some words that you realize I've been wanting this word for my whole life, you know, and to grok means to kind of like internalize and understand something, like to kind of get it in a way. And I just think that's such a great word.
Exactly.
For this kind of thing. Yeah. And it seems to be like a certain
science fiction, man.
Yeah. But I mean, a lot of science fiction is about creativity, and a lot of science fiction writers understand the creative process in their own way.
Totally. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
It's a kind of fluency in music, it seems like, what you're talking about, where like being musically fluent, like everyone's brains are different, but being able to hear chords pass by and know what chords they are, or know how they relate to each other, or know how they relate to the tune that's being played, or, you know, I'm trying to make sure I understand, like reflectively listening to what you're talking about and like what this applied theory really means.
Yeah, right. I kind of like, some people are really proactively aware that that would enrich their entire experience and they're hungry for it. And again, about 85% of my clientele, my teaching clientele, are under the age of 16. So it's a little unusual, because a lot of kids are just like, show me another great tune that I can just like shred. So you almost have to like spoon feed them or sneak it in. And I am a pretty sneaky teacher. I'm a kind of a chucklehead, you know. I always find like some kind of way to talk, you know, outside of the topic at hand, you know, like, you know, sort of like be their buddy. How's it going? And, you know, about them Red Sox and kind of thing. And, you know, or what's, you know, tell me something that you're like, kind of like really find frustrating about, you know, doing math on Zoom, or, you know, it's worth 5 minutes of any lesson to get personable. And then it's a lot easier to sneak some theory in. And I'm even upfront about it. Sometimes I'll say, like, you know, spoiler alert, in about 2 minutes, we're going to spend about 5 minutes talking theory. You can log off anytime. It just gets them laughing about it, and then we just go for it. But there's a few kids that are like, "Yeah, that's really great. It's really helpful."
So when you talk theory,
adults,
theory, what does that look like?
What does that look like? It's like. We start usually with there. I've got, oh my God, we could take so long here on this. You know, I try to make them articulate as much as possible how they actually picture it in three dimensions. Cause to me, it is very cinematic and landscape, like, you know, chords, which are the three dimensional embodiment of theory in a way. Or a good part of it, are all about emotion, right? Okay, so if you hit, you know, a four chord or a four over a one instead of just, you know, a one, It takes you someplace. If you hit the six minor instead of the one, it's all about emotion. If you make a ninth chord out of it, it's emotional. Every step of the way, every piece of the game is a new piece of landscape, is a new color in there. So it's more like, let's try this. Okay, what are you seeing right now? Like, what does that really do to your experience of the tune to have that happening? And I try to get them talking about that.
Mm.
You know, like, and if they can articulate something about it, then that's useful to me to know which direction to go next. And me being like fairly well-known, you know, crazy guy with chords up there and on the dance stage, just to bring this full circle here, you know, that's like, you know, it's working all the time. I feel like it's a playground, and contrarian music involves this ability, you know, first of all, assuming that I have free reign, I don't have a co-creator of the chordal zone, which occasionally, you know, you do, but there's no bass player in our current unit in the posse. And it's not very often that, that Tristan on the guitar and me on the piano haven't carved out complementary roles where we don't really have to, meet and interact verbally or otherwise, with, like, you know, exactly the chord pattern. If we do, we certainly do work it out ahead of time, but most of the time it's my zone or it's his zone. So I'm okay. There I am up there on the piano. I can basically do any stuff. I can do anything I want. I really can do anything I want. Mm-hmm. That's just a shocking amount of freedom when you get right down to it. And we're not even talking about the rhythmic part, which is its own shocking amount of freedom, but just the chordal part. And I think it goes back, talk about science fiction. It goes back to, with great power comes great responsibility. Well, of course, it has to tell a story, you know, for the dancers, you know, 8 bars, 16 bars, 32 bars, the major moments where we all should be very connected, you know, we on stage and they on the floor and the collar as kind of the conduit. You know, we have to kind of touch base with a certain amount of reality, you know, that is grounding. Okay. So if I've gone crazy with chords, I always have that in mind. I think all of us who have been able to continue to get gigs with contradance music, and in the backup role, we know this, you know, it's not just like do anything you want. Ha ha. It's do a lot of what you want, but there are rules and there are lines and you have to kind of like, you have to play nice. Yeah. You have to continue to play nice. But that still leaves so much space to do that. So I am generally telling stories. I think we could all articulate some version of that, right? With the chord patterns that are either prefab and I'm bringing them into the game, because we all do that. I call those plugins with my students. You know, it's just like we throw a plug-in. It's time for a 1-6-2-5, or it's time for the slow building ascension, or it's time to sit on the pedal tone, or it's time to sit on the 5 sus, or whatever. Those are all kind of plugins. And we know where they happen, and we know how long they can happen, and where they have to resolve to, or what the next plugin is, and so forth. So all of that is in my mind, but sometimes it's totally crazily spontaneous as well. Those two kind of like games or three or whatever it is, are all happening at once. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe it's like three-dimensional chess.
Yeah.
or maybe some dimensional chess or something, that I'm keeping track of. Of course, I'm a fiddler, so I know the tune.
Right.
Even the tunes that I've never played, that in the case of the posse, you know, some blistering technical quasi-Irish tune that Oliver made up. That I've never played and never will play on the fiddle. I still kind of know the tune.
You grok it.
I grok it, exactly. So yeah. I know where I am able and not able to go. Another way, it's really cool to be able to talk about this, actually. Another direction that I go that also ties in with teaching is they're like puzzles. Tunes are like puzzles. Hmm. If you're trying to learn a tune, it's like a puzzle. And you recognize a lot of the puzzle once you've put puzzles together for a while. It's like, oh, this is another reel in D. I kind of like know the sort of the average sort of like where it's going to go. And I know kind of like an ending-ish sort of thing that probably will happen. And I know exactly when that'll happen. And yet there's that part. There's that one part that kind of makes the tune unique. And it involves some finger pattern perhaps that is unexpected. Okay, so that's the puzzle we have to unlock there for a more advanced player. In the beginning, everything is a puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, no, that's your second finger, not your first finger. There's some basic puzzling right there. But the chord piece is also a puzzle. And I enjoy those kind of things. And I am proud of like rarely being stumped, I guess. That's like one of my things. It's like, God damn it, I'm going to figure out this missing chord if it just, you know, if I end up panting on the floor on the stage, you know, afterwards because of from the exertion or whatever.
Do you mean like when a tune is asking for a certain chord and you're trying to find that special chord for that
it's
moment?
It's usually, exactly. Oh my God. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's usually an original tune of somebody's that is not following any rules. You know, they're just like, oh, it's kind of cool. It's going to go to like, you know, a flat six and then a two minor or and then a two flat minor. Or is it, you know, something that's like no traditional tune ever does and never will. And then you're going like, your eyes get all narrow and slitty and, you know, like there's something weird here. And then you're into advanced puzzling. That's the 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle, you know, with probably, you know, about 65 pieces that look exactly alike.
And they're all beige.
they're all sky.
Yeah. Yeah, right, exactly. Oh, yeah, Noah does that with the tunes he writes. If he throws a new tune at me, I'm like, oh, there's that thing. Oh, missed it. I'll try this chord. And every time the tune goes by, you try a new chord in that spot, which is kind of all you can muster sometimes in real time. And you get kind of squinty at. I sort of look up at the ceiling. That's what I apparently do when I'm fishing for ideas. And, you know, you just keep trying things and see if something sticks. It's a fun game. But sometimes
There's a lot of information up there on the ceiling.
Yeah, that's where I keep all my notes.
Perhaps the last band that played there, maybe they left some vital piece of information up there. If you just squint, you can see it.
So, oh, that would be great if we all left graffiti for other bands on the ceiling where no one else would see it. That'd be so cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
145 was here.
Yeah. Chord chart in large print. Here, try this.
Circle of fists.
This might work. This might work. Try a two minor.
Yeah.
Worked for me.
Thanks for listening to ContraPulse. This project is supported by CDSS, the Country Dance and Song Society, and is produced by Ben Williams. Thanks to Great Meadow Music for the use of tunes from the album Old New England by Bob McQuillan, Jane Orzechowski, and Deanna Stiles. Visit ContraPulse.cdss.org for more info. Happy dancing!